Are we being spied on? This is a not very long talk, but it has a long-winded subtitle, which is, how much undercover policing does a capitalist state need to protect what it regards as its national interest? That's the long subtitle. And the inspiration for it comes from several sources, one of them being a very recent five-part BBC Radio 4 investigative series entitled Shadow World, The People versus MacDonald. It was researched and presented by Mark Steele, who some of you may know, and some of you may in fact have heard the series. And it was largely about the so-called MacLibel case in the 1990s, when two anti-McDonald's Greenpeace campaigners were pursued through the courts by McDonald's for producing a leaflet which claimed, which made claims about that company's activities and methods, in particular, the negative effect of these on the environment. These were claims which McDonald's said were libelous. And they then proceeded to spend a fortune prosecuting the case, which lasted the best part of 10 years and, in fact, has been the longest running lawsuit in British history. I can say a bit more about that later if people want me to, but that's a bit of a sideshow for our purposes here. Because one of the most interesting things to emerge from it was the discovery by one of the Greenpeace campaigners that a member of her group, who was also someone she'd engaged in a two-year personal relationship with, was in fact a police infiltrator and informer. After those 2 years, he just vanished. But when she later tracked him down, it emerged that while he was still with her, he was actually married to someone else. She also discovered that other undercover policemen had had relationships with other female activists, over 60 of them in all from small groups deemed to be suspect. One of these policemen had in fact been involved with four different women, with one of whom he'd fathered a child. And in the course of this series, Mark Steele himself revealed that as a member of one such suspect group himself in the 1980s, the Socialist Workers Party, that is, his branch had discovered that one of their most active members was a police infiltrator. And more broadly, he found from records now available that between 1968 and 2008, Special Branch oversaw what he referred to as a massive expensive palaver. That is, they carried out spying on more than 1,000 different organisations in Britain. Now, I said the inspiration for this talk came from more than one source. And the second of these, the first one is this radio series that was on very recently. The second of these is a book I read and reviewed for the Socialist Standard 2 or 3 years ago. Its title was, I don't know the extent to which you can see it on the screen, The Red List, MI5 and British Intellectuals in the 20th Century. And its author was David Cout. It's quite a tome. It's about 400 pages. And it's a deeply researched book that draws upon official MI5 documents, which had been released to the National Archive, and this made them publicly available. And in these documents, Cout found startling insights into the enormous efforts and the massive resources that had gone into tracking the activities and affiliations of an extraordinarily wide range of people. These were people who, at different times over the 20th century, were suspected of being sympathetic to or interested in regimes deemed to be enemies of the British state, or who more generally were seen as constituting a possible threat to national security. for much of this time, MI5 was, as you might imagine, especially interested in the CPGB, the Communist Party of Great Britain, because of its connections with the Soviet Union. But it also went in for trying to investigate any other organizations or individuals it considered potentially subversive. Examples of this, we learn from Kautz's book, were small left-wing groups, trade unions, supporters of national independence in colonial areas, and from the 1970s onwards, possible supporters of the IRA. The book makes abundantly clear that in these investigations, MI5 didn't really have too much of a clue about who might be potential subversives. And so any group deemed to be left-wing or with the word socialist in its name or in the materials it put out was likely to be targeted. And according to the author, that may still be the case today. From the released papers which were investigated by Kautz, he found that Special Branch, which was a sort of subsection of MI5, carried out countless phone taps, mail interceptions, buggings, burglaries, physical surveillance, and even infiltration by moles. The trouble was, as I've said, that they didn't really have much idea as to whether particular organizations or individuals constituted genuine, plausible threats to national security. So as Kautz tells us, this is a quote, the net cast was incredibly broad and guilt by association was paramount, even if that association was sometimes more imagined than real. In which case, given such circumstances, it wouldn't be that surprising if the SPGB could not be sensibly categorized as any kind of immediate threat to national security. We might be, and that may still be the case today, where we might be lumped together with those organizations that could reasonably be seen as some kind of threat, even if, of course, in reality, most of them aren't. The whole thing, in fact, was, in Kautz's words, an exercise in glaring incompetence and bungling, and maybe still is. One of the reasons for this, in the past at least, he tells us, was that the lenses of MI5 were clouded by being staffed at the top by former out-of-touch military and colonial officers, and on the ground by agents, the so-called special branch operatives, who were simply not very bright. And he writes with considerable wit and dry, laconic humour, and he really goes to town on this, giving details, for example, of how they often included manifestly irrelevant and sometimes unintentionally comic details in their reports. So, for example, surveillance of the home of the poet C. Day Lewis produced such vital information as he seldom wears a hat, not altogether smart appearance in dress, and an agent reporting from Harwich on the radical historian Christopher Hill, returning from Russia, wrote, he has the appearance of a communist, but his baggage, which was searched by HM Customs, did not contain any subversive literature. The contents of the papers examined also reveal MI5 culture as highly bigoted, in particular, and perhaps predictably, racist and anti-Semitic. One memo quoted states that the chief Bolshevik leaders are not Russians but Jews who carefully hide their real names. Another report talks about a suspect's home being visited by, I quote, a number of young men who have the appearance of communist Jews. Then an uncle of the historian and Communist Party member, Eric Hobsbawm, is described as, I quote, sneering, half Jew in appearance, having a long nose. And I should add that Kautz makes clear that though he's had access to voluminous material, much of it is in redacted form, and a large amount has still not been released at all. So who knows what more it could reveal about people or organizations who were or who are being spied on. And who knows whether there wouldn't be reference to the Socialist Party and any covert investigations carried out over the years into both our organisation and its members. That doesn't appear at all unlikely, in fact, even if we are actually mentioned in this book. One last point, Kaut has a whole chapter on the complicity of the BBC in all this. It's entitled BBC Toes the Line and illustrates how, at least until recent times, the BBC was, as he puts it, as wryly as ever, up MI5's armpit. How the BBC functioned, therefore, very much as, this is how the BBC functioned, very much as a servile collaborator of the secret services. He calls the BBC a semi-covert department of state and reveals that it even carried out extensive vetting procedures on those within the organisation to check whether there was any sniff of subversion about them. So far we've seen stuff that's been written about by an author like Kaut and stuff that's been reported on by an investigator like Steele. But these aren't the only sources of inspiration for this talk. I actually have a couple of hands-on, highly personal ones to tell you about. I have to go back quite some time for the first one, but one evening there was a ring on the front door of the terraced house I lived in at the time in Swansea. When I went to the door, I was faced with a smartly dressed young man carrying a briefcase. He said right away that he was selling insurance. Yes, these were the days when insurance was still sold door to door. Quite a few of you will probably remember that. But he quickly added that what he was really interested in was the Socialist Party of Great Britain and how could he join. I'm not making this up, by the way. I was obviously surprised, but I still remember, felt very pleased, even a bit excited. Someone was actually coming round to my house to find out about socialism. In retrospect, as you'll see, you might say that I was naivety personified, but I invited him in and we sat down in the front room. He said he knew something about the party and liked it, but asked me to tell him more. So I tried to sum up as briefly as I could what we stood for: moneyless, wageless, democratic world of free access to all goods and services, without leaders or lead, based on the idea that this will all come about when the majority class in society, those who have to work for a wage or salary, develop the consciousness necessary to democratically take power from the tiny minority who own and control the wealth, or something like that. Okay, don't remember the exact words, obviously. Andrew, which was his name, seemed enthusiastic. And just as enthusiastically, I started to show him some of the party's leaflets and pamphlets, which were in my pamphlets cupboard. He seemed particularly interested in certain things, for example, where we stood on the use of violence. I obviously told him we were opposed to it. He was also keen to know our position on what was going on in Ireland at the time. It was the time of the Troubles. I told him we supported neither side. He seemed satisfied with this and asked if he could become a member and could he pay the subscription there and then. I told him he didn't have to pay a subscription to join, but he couldn't join there and then. I told him that if he came to our next branch meeting on a Monday evening at Swansea Central Library, he could apply for membership there. One of the things he did was to keep apologising for being an insurance salesman while patting his briefcase and sort of apologising for it, telling me he needed the job to support his family. Of course, I said, yeah, okay. And eventually left, promising to come to our next branch meeting. Now, I felt not a little exhilarated. Until, that is, my wife emerged from the adjacent room where she'd been eavesdropping on everything that had gone on. "He's a policeman," she said, without hesitation and with complete conviction. Wow. It took a second or two to sink in, but then it struck home. It had to be a bit peculiar that this stranger should come to the house and start asking questions, not just about the party, but specifically about violence and Northern Ireland. When I reflected, I thought, yes, I've been naive. But I also thought that maybe that was a good job. After all, if he was some kind of undercover policeman, who knows? He might have had a weapon in that briefcase he kept patting, and he might produce it if or when he was rumbled and challenged. And then that actually felt a bit scary. Now, is this all a bit overdramatic? And was there a perfectly rational, non-dramatic explanation? Well, I never really found out, because, of course, Andrew never came to any of our branch meetings, but I did see him again. And it was about a year later. This was when, with a group of local party comrades, I went to a public meeting which was being organised by the IMG, the International Marxist Group. Some of you will remember them. We stood outside in Swansea city centre trying to sell our standards and handing out leaflets before the meeting began. Then we went in. I was walking down one of the aisles to find a seat, and a young, casually, almost hippily dressed man was coming in the opposite direction. So he was coming towards me, and he seemed to be one of the organisers. As he reached me, he said hello, looked awkward, and then sort of blurted out that he was out of the insurance game now. And how was I? I hadn't recognised him at first, but then I realised who it was. It was him. It was Andrew. I reciprocated his hello and sat down. Now, you'll make of that what you will, but would it be entirely paranoid of me to regard this as confirmation that Andrew, that was his real name, was a police spy, an undercover cop? Maybe. But taken in conjunction with David Couch's revelations and what Mark Steele had to say on his radio series, it can't be entirely implausible. And there's also one more thread to this, and it's another personal one, something that happened in Swansea a number of years after the events I've just recounted. At that time, our branch of the party was holding its meetings in a room in the Queen's Hotel, a pub on the edge of the Swansea city centre. The pub's actually still there, unlike most others these days. We were in a phase of advertising our fortnightly Monday meetings via posters, leaflets, and also in the daily the local daily paper, with a view to getting people in the good old days, you might say. For one of our meetings, I arrived at the pub early. I was standing at the bar when the landlady informed me casually and quite innocently that a detective had been there asking about us. What were we doing, he wanted to know. I thanked her for telling me and said that if he came back, she could tell him that our meetings were open to everyone and that he could attend, and we'd be happy to tell him precisely what we were doing. And that was that. Needless to say, neither he nor any other detective attended, and we heard nothing more. But at the time, it did make me think of conversations among party members about thinking they were being spied on, or about a new visitor suddenly attending meetings, or about a new person quickly joining and then leaving, or about suspecting they were having their phone tapped. I suspected that for quite a long time, rightly or wrongly. But in the end, I have to say that despite these incidents and stories, I'd long tended to take this kind of suspicion with at least a small pinch of salt. But if I now put it together with Couch's book and with Steele's revelations, it does take on a somewhat different complexion, for me anyway, and it's sort of shifted my own thinking. This, of course, raises the question, why? Why would they do it? Why would they spy on us? If officers of MI5, Special Branch, or any other kind of police ever attended our meetings or found out in some other way what we were about, surely they would quickly realise, as I presume Andrew, who came to the house, did, that we didn't pose a threat to national security, at least not an immediate one. It's true to say that we are what might be called dissidents, but not in the sense of supporting one government or state against another or advocating violent action, which is what one presumes they'd be looking out for. So if we have been or are being spied on, what's it all about? Well, David Count's description of the incompetence of the so-called security services, what he calls their stumbling confusion, may provide a clue. He tells us that they seem to find it almost impossibly difficult to work out whether particular individuals or organizations constituted genuine, plausible threats to so-called national security, or whether such people just happened to be saying or doing things that weren't entirely conventional, or just found themselves in particular places at particular times. So, as he puts it, the netcast was incredibly broad and guilt by association was paramount. In that light, it doesn't seem so surprising that the Socialist Party and its members, though we couldn't be categorised sensibly as any kind of immediate threat to national security, should be, and maybe still are, lumped together with those who perhaps could be seen as some kind of threat. One last somewhat wider reflection. We know that the capitalist system, because of the way it works, engenders enormous waste of all description, both human and material. And it's clear, as David Count's book uncovers and Mark Steele's series show, that the spy industry, just like any other so-called security operation, is no exception to that. In other words, it engenders a colossal squandering of time, energy, and resources, which Mark Steele labelled as a massive, expensive palaver. Our take on this, of course, is that waste of this kind is an inevitable function of a social system that pits capitalist classes and governments of all description against one another, even, of course, those who may falsely call themselves communist or socialist or Marxist. They are perpetually battling for political and economic control of the world's resources. And it also throws significant light on the severe limitations that this system, even in so-called liberal democracies, inevitably imposes or tries to impose, even if not very, very effectively, like by institutions like MI5, on freedom of speech and the free exchange of ideas and thought. In the end, therefore, capitalism, whether it takes the form of state control or of a relatively unfettered market, needs a system of state secrecy, even if it's a bungling, imperfect one, to assist the national interest of each country's wealth holders in their never-ending quest for profit as they go on competing with one another on the world market. Right, I finish now and happy to take questions or hear comments. Thank you very much.